Welcome to the HN Pod, your daily dive into the front page of Hacker News.
Great to be here.
It's Wednesday, May 14th, 2025, and this is our 34th deep dive into the day's top tech talk.
And quite a lineup today.
Yeah, we're aiming to cut through the noise and give you the key insights from five big stories. We've got AlphaVolve, that's a Gemini-powered coding agent.
Mm-hmm.
Then the perennial question, what is HDR anyway?
Always a good one.
Shanghai letting riders design bus routes. That sounds interesting.
Definitely innovative.
The lost file upload feature in the Nextcloud Android app. Bit drama there.
Always some platform tension.
And finally, Databricks acquiring Neon. Big move in the data world.
Yeah, lots to unpack there. It's fascinating how these discussions, you know, touch on AI, displays, transport, apps, data infrastructure.
Yeah.
They all connect to bigger tech trends.
Absolutely. Let's kick off with AlphaVolve. So the core idea is an AI agent using Gemini, right?
Right.
And it's automating that whole loop of debugging code, optimizing it, stuff that usually needs a human developer.
Exactly. We've seen AI do optimization before, but usually in really tightly defined spaces like hyperparameter tuning.
But this feels broader. And it immediately sparked that big question in the discussion. Could this lead to LLMs designing, you know, new LLMs? Maybe even ones we can't fully understand.
Yeah, that's sci-fi question again. But practically speaking, some users pointed out its usefulness is totally tied to the underlying Gemini model.
Right. Like, will it just get stuck in a loop if you give it a basic optimize this code prompt?
That's the worry. And there were some pretty funny comments about that. Someone joked it would just add a skip to a test and call it optimized.
Or like an AI adding as any everywhere to fix TypeScript errors. The Vibe Coder comment was great too.
It really highlights that you need good metrics, right? Yeah. Otherwise, the AI might optimize in ways that are actually harmful.
Definitely. But then the discussion took a really interesting turn, this idea of self-play.
Ah, yeah, using random variation. The idea is maybe this could solve the synthetic data problem for coding, math, even some science.
So AI generating its own training data, basically, overcoming the need for massive human-labeled data sets as we run out of useful human stuff.
Exactly. Could be a big boost for scaling reinforcement learning.
Although some will push back on that.
Right. Saying it sounds more like a genetic algorithm or, you know, other methods like Monte Carlo are used in computational biology.
So more like evolution than pure RL learning.
Kind of. The key ingredients are a good evaluation function, the energy function, and a fast enough way to generate variations, like an LLM, plus enough compute power.
Got it. And the meta question came up, has AlphaVolve improved itself yet?
Always a fun one to ask.
On the optimistic side, people see it as this potential genius coder AI that never sleeps. Insane potential, right?
Huge potential. But then, the crucial reality check, numerical stability.
Ooh, yeah. If it's automatically optimizing numerical algorithms, ensuring they don't break down with certain inputs is tricky.
Very tricky. And it connects back to that AI accelerating AI development idea. Is this a step towards an intelligence explosion?
Some think so, but others are more cautious, saying, look, this only works for optimizing well-defined behaviors with clear metrics. It's not general intelligence.
It's optimizing, not inventing in a broad sense. The conversation also touched on wanting a definitive Wikipedia before AI maybe, you know, butchers it for ads.
Yeah, that resonates. There was praise for Gemini 2.0, but also that cynicism about everything becoming a subscription service.
Contracted with the hope of running powerful LLMs locally, yeah.
And then the focus shifted a bit. Okay, maybe AI solves coding, but what about software engineering?
Big difference. Defining what to build. Requirements, dependencies, user impact, reliability, failover.
All that stuff. How does unlimited resources from AI change how we prioritize? Does everything just get built?
Which led to the idea that maybe software engineers become like glorified test engineers?
Defining test cases for the AI to code against. Interesting flip. Someone even drew a parallel to the game Go.
Yeah, the complexity argument. But the conclusion was, code generation and testing isn't the whole story. There's brownfield development, vague requirements, business consequences. AI can't read intent yet.
True. Okay, switching gears. HDR. What is HDR anyway? The article dug into the history a bit.
Right, back to the 90s, dealing with dynamic range. Early HDR mode involved multiple exposures.
And tone mapping algorithms, like Reinhard, to squish those HDR values onto standard screens. Photomatics came out of this.
But users hated fiddling with sliders, apparently. Not very intuitive.
No. So then came single-shot tone mapping, analogous to dodging and burning in film photography.
Exactly. Focusing on preserving detail, especially as sensors got better, closer to film's dynamic range.
And the visual impact on modern screens is compared to the jump from analog to HDTV. That's huge.
It can be, but it hasn't hit critical mass, even after 9 years. Cost and effort for the industries involved, TV, film, photography, that's a big lift.
Reminds me of how long HDTV took to really take hold.
Similar challenges. And then there's the weirdness, like HDR photos rendering badly in Apple's own Photos app.
But fine on Instagram, that's bizarre.
Shows the implementation challenges. Halide, the camera app, even released HDR support in a limited beta, partly because of potential support issues.
What a headache. A key point from HEN was separating HDR capture, formats, and display.
Crucial distinction. HDR capture and formats existed before HDR displays. It was about getting more detail in the negative, essentially.
Allowing re-exposure after capture, which Ansel Adams couldn't really do. So saying he used HDR is maybe not quite right in the modern sense?
Probably not. He mastered capturing high dynamic range scenes for the print using his zone system, but post-capture adjustment is different. The discussion even questioned the term HDR itself.
Saying all mediums have a range, and HDR on monitors is more about communicating brightness capabilities.
Yeah, and what happens when content brightness exceeds what the display can do? Does it clip? Does it map it down?
So HDR can sometimes just mean tone mapping a high-range source onto a standard display.
Where high just refers to the original scene having more range, and wide gamut colors part of it too. But it gets treated like a simple on-off switch, which is frustrating.
Totally. Someone shared an anecdote about their retro corner with a CRT TV.
Ah, yes, appreciating older formats. Laserdisc apparently had amazing colors compared to DVD or Blu-ray.
Interesting contrast.
Yeah.
But back to Adams, the point was made that while use HDR is vague, he was capturing high dynamic range scenes. Mm. Factually true.
And his zone system was about managing those tones for the print. It connects to old research on making global illumination user-friendly, discussing light variability.
So his dodging and burning was a form of managing exposure within the film's high dynamic range for the final print.
Pretty much, adjusting locally to reveal detail. There was also a note about potential confusion between HDR in games versus photography.
Right, handled differently. And the argument resurfaced that analog photographers did work in HDR because film had more range than paper.
Their darkroom techniques aim to preserve that range. But there's a counter concern. Modern movie HDR sometimes looks flat, washed out.
Yeah, reduced contrast, even in non-CGI films. Not what you'd expect.
Speaks to artistic choice and execution, kind of like how YouTube is trying volume normalization with that new stable volume feature, trying to create consistency.
Feels like we need better OS and format standards for HDR to avoid those visual issues. Like maybe audio standards, though spatial audio like Atmos has its own interoperability problems.
Standardization is key. Someone mentioned HDR feeling like it ignores screen brightness settings.
Because the slider might only control the SDR range, and HDR goes beyond that.
Exactly. Brighter colors are a benefit, but often poorly done in video. Newer phone photo HDR is generally better, more restrained.
Does the limited support just mean weak demand? Or is it more complex?
Well, it's popular in AAA console gaming, suggesting interest is there. Maybe PC platform barriers are the issue.
And the classic complaint. Blindingly bright subtitles in dark HDR scenes.
So annoying. We also saw anecdotes about not seeing much difference between 4K and 1080p at normal viewing distances.
Especially with broadcast content. Good upscaling matters more sometimes. But 120Hz displays, noticeable difference.
Smoother motion seems more immediately impactful for some. And a quick aside about going straight from CDs to streaming, skipping MP3 players.
Huh. The segment wrapped up by mentioning AI can't read intent key for software and confusion over that article's before after HDR photo, where the before looked like a flat grading source.
Right. Probably intended for editing.
Okay, let's fly over to Shanghai. Riders designing their own bus routes.
Yeah, this crowdsourced transit platform. Propose, vote, potentially activate new lines in just days.
Yeah.
School drop-offs, commuters, seniors going to hospitals.
Super flexible. An expert opinion was that it builds on Shanghai's already dense network to match capacity and demand better.
Yeah.
Improves convenience, resource use.
Makes sense. There's a popular customization page for proposals. Others opt in. Group bookings speed things up. Fares are market-based. No special discounts yet.
The deputy director acknowledged it's faster than the old way, but they have early challenges. Uneven demand, low awareness, still need manual field work. Plans to improve, though.
HM reactions seemed mostly positive. Smart, low-tech, self-optimizing based on demand.
Contrasted with fixed schedules. Raise the Uber-like idea of dynamic coordination, maybe even switching vehicles, as long as journey times are predictable.
Predictability is key for transit, but then the big question, you need a smartphone, right?
Yeah, potential exclusion issue. But the counter was, smartphone penetration is sky high in China. Even teens have smartwatches for payments.
So it's becoming like assuming people wear shoes to use sidewalks, a baseline assumption.
Kinda. And smartphones are used for everything there. But someone else chimed in, saying they rarely update their phone, refuse certain apps.
Personal choice. And the point that lawmakers should worry about utility for all citizens, not just the majority.
True. The response was, well, if it's an ad hoc service, maybe those without smartphones can't expect it to work for them.
Like not having a car for a car service. Some preferred predictable train subways anyway, suggested kiosks or coin bill options at existing stops for access.
Like courts needing paper from some, e-filing from lawyers, or the perceived invasiveness of electronic health records.
Which led to the slightly dystopian concern, needing a smartphone, SIM, ID, bank account, specific device just for public transport.
Though a basic dumb phone backup was suggested, and the view that this likely augments static routes doesn't replace them. Potential benefits outweigh valid concerns for some.
That supplemental role makes sense. We heard anecdotes about smartphones for bike rentals, restaurant orders, payments in China, cash cards rare.
But a contrasting travel experience in Chongqing in 2023, without a SIM, worked fine public Wi-Fi, cash cards accepted on transport, preference against needing internet for buses.
Shows variation exists. The discussion highlighted how much reliable, shorter wait times matter.
Huge difference compared to long, unpredictable waits. Even just knowing bus capacity, like NYC's bus time, helps.
Definitely. Then the idea of private vans on regular routes came up, a middle ground between big buses and cars.
Could be great, but labor costs are an issue. Not common in rich cities, except maybe unregulated gypsy cabs with their own problems.
And the idea of taxi Uber drivers deciding autonomously to follow busy routes with standard fares.
Interesting. Public authorities use subcontractors, but vertical integration is often more cost-effective. Private operators might skip less profitable but needed routes. Automated buses could change that calculus, though.
Big potential shift there. Hong Kong's minibuses were mentioned, passengers calling out stops, fixed routes versus less defined ones.
Right, the y'all look instruction. And flag stop zones on some free circulators hop on off anywhere safe.
Led to the debate.
Yeah.
Charge for those circulators. Revenue for more service versus free stimulating the economy. Also, microtransit concepts.
Microtransit has had mixed results, yeah. How about booking apps on regular routes? Gather data, offer pickup guarantees, maybe use rented cars. Use data to adjust routes. That's data-driven optimization. Do bus companies even track where people get on off now? Facial recognition was floated.
Yikes. Privacy concerns there, and the point that flexible routes lose the mass efficiency of mass transit.
Contrasting experiences with private local transport came up India, Latin America. One view, great. Another from Brazil, potential anarchy, fights for passengers, unsafe driving. Preferred the regulated system now.
Regulation and safety are paramount. Oh, and the plural of buses.
Quick etymology break, then. Back to transport as state power, the capabilities needed.
Centralized planning, like Switzerland, Japan, often private operation, versus fragmented U.S. systems. Suggestion that centralization with oversight can be better.
Though private transit was big in the U.S. historically, until monopolization caused issues.
Competition good, monopoly, public or private, tends towards profit or our efficiency, not always both. And the roads is car subsidy argument. If cars paid their way, private buses might compete better.
Shanghai's initiative seen as valuable data. Quicker than long studies, though app data has biases. Similar private combis in South America mentioned.
And the view that China's capability allows this, contrasting with Western bureaucracy.
Though Warsaw, Poland was given as a counterexample of excellent modern transit in the West. Comparing transit versus car times, costs. Good city design should favor transit.
Adding massive services costly. Needs funding, long-term planning for people to adjust. Sometimes you cut bad routes to fund better ones. Dublin bus success story was mentioned.
Nice. Infrastructure and government form discussion. Strong states needed. Baumol's cost disease. Contrasted with decentralized Switzerland, U.S. planning history sometimes a hindrance.
Voters should decide resource allocation, elect oversight. American enthusiasm for private companies tackling transit noted against the historical backdrop.
Maybe government form isn't the key factor. Good infrastructure exists across the spectrum. culture and resistance to change highlighted as barriers sometimes.
The U.S. bathroom stall gap example came up humorously.
Countered by historical doorless public toilets in China. Comparing different countries is hard density matters. China versus Australia.
Context is key. And a final concern, would voting engagement drop off after initial routes are set?
Yeah. Core challenge, often funding and political will, not lack of ideas. Maybe enforcing existing laws could fund improvements, though that raises worries about policing incentives.
Complex trade-offs everywhere.
Okay, on to the data world. Databricks acquires Neon. Big discussion.
Yeah, starting with the argument that data warehousing is becoming a commodity.
Thanks to open source like Iceberg, Trino, Superset, examples of companies slashing costs, building their own platforms, Kubernetes operators, on-prem S3 options, makes you question Databricks' high valuation, right?
It definitely puts pressure on them. Building your own gives cost savings, control. But the counterpoint was the complexity.
Day two operations, right? Expanding clusters, changing, erase your coding, random access within files. Not trivial.
Exactly. That's where managed platforms still offer value. There was also a critical view of cloud platforms becoming inshittified, ripe for acquisition.
Questioning Databricks' value prop for new projects,
right,
while acknowledging the lock-in for existing enterprise clients, is just hosting Spark that groundbreaking anymore? Is Spark even right for most needs?
More doubts about the valuation, and someone immediately disliked the Databricks website needing cookies. Small things matter.
They do. Then we heard from someone rejected by Neon the day the acquisition was announced.
Ouch. They were actually happy, citing bad past acquisition experiences. Hoped Neon wouldn't change too much.
Another shared a similar negative story, contrasted with the view that acquisitions can be interesting times to join, especially if you like scaling and integration.
Depends on your experience and perspective. One person shared a tough story. Layoffs, culture clash, burnout after an acquisition.
It really highlighted the human cost. And the uncertainty for early employees with equity payouts aren't always huge after preferred shares.
Important financial reality. On the tech side, potential synergy. Neon's scale to zero Postgres with Databricks' Unity catalog could simplify pipelines.
But the big concern, Neon's future as open source under Databricks.
Always a worry with acquisitions like this. We also heard from a Databricks employee who loves working there, saying the HN negativity doesn't match internal or customer feedback.
Though they acknowledge Databricks sometimes ships features fast, maybe a bit unpolished.
Good to get that internal perspective. HN tends to be critical, but you look for the signals, the trends, and the concerns.
Someone joked about database creation metrics being skewed by AI agents spinning them up.
Could do. Neon's basic premise S3 for bottomless Postgres storage was explained. Why pay when you could maybe host it yourself? Role of open source there.
Then the profitability debate. How important is it for startup valuation and M&A? Differing views, market share versus profit. Databricks is reportedly profitable, but a VC perspective might view their financials differently. It depends who's looking and why.
Valuation is definitely multifaceted in tech M&A.
Okay, last one. The next cloud app for Android losing its file upload feature.
Right. Blamed on Google's stricter, least privileged storage policies.
The core argument on HN. Google's own apps get privileged access, while independent vendors like Nextcloud are forced to ship incomplete products or get booted from the Play Store.
Reducing user choice, wasting developer time, that's the claim, highlights the platform power imbalance.
Users felt these choices should be theirs, not Google's. Someone noted Apple seems to get away with similar restrictions more easily, maybe due to customer mentality.
Different ecosystems, different expectations, perhaps. There was a call for antitrust action, but skepticism about current enforcement effectiveness. Small fines don't change incentives.
And the problems lasted 5 months, potentially costing Nextcloud users.
Antitrust is complex. U.S. law often needs consumer price harm. EU focuses on market fairness, but rarely gets this technically granular. Browser choice was a high-level exception.
Led to hopes for quality Linux phones for real user control, calling Google Apple OCC's for-profit prisons, mentioning bloatware waste.
The intended alternative is the Storage Access Framework, SAF. but reports say it's slow due to inter-process communication calls.
Big performance difference compared to native operations. Even recent experience suggests it's still poor, despite reported improvements.
Performance matters. Google's rationale is security stopping malicious apps abusing broad permissions, like manage external storage.
Legitimate concern. But the counter is, shouldn't a reputable app like Nextcloud be an exception?
That's the argument. Plus, the observation that Google Drive seems to have easier access for things like backup compared to what third-party apps get via SAF raises questions about fairness.
And other apps grabbing too much data suspiciously.
Yeah.
Broader privacy worries.
The sync thing history came up. Dropped official client due to workload, community fork using SAF but facing Play Store issues. Shows app workarounds are possible but complex.
Key question. Do Google's own apps follow the same rules for similar features? Clarification was that Drive's upload uses an ASS file picker.
Which Nextcloud claims isn't good enough for their background sync use case? Syncing specific folders is possible with SAF APIs.
Actionable pin document tree and permissions.
Mm-hmm.
But enumerating files can be slow, impacts background sync performance, battery life.
The slowness is mainly binder IPC overhead, not CPU bound, but still significant compared to local operations, one view. Google's apps probably don't have all files access either. SAC sync should suffice. DMA applies equally.
But countered by, the OS itself has capabilities not given to devs, like iOS, unlike Windows Linux, dismissing just install AOSP or sideloading as impractical for most.
Like the old just install another browser argument. Alternative ODs like EOS mentioned, but with critiques on updates and bootloaders.
Then the take that punishing Google for preventing unfettered data access is questionable, given malware history. Privacy APIs exist. Maybe Nextcloud doesn't want to use them.
A middle ground suggested broader access requires explicit opt-in, like other permissions. Can Google Drive upload all file types without broader permissions? Unclear.
Someone brought up Google's old don't be evil motto, seeing this as a restrictive shift, like Microsoft's past actions that led to things like Nextcloud.
The irony. Ideal scenario mentioned offer users both full access and controlled access options.
And a final thought. Maybe a DMCA-like law to quickly scrutinize platform actions that harm interoperability and choice.
An interesting regulatory idea.
Well, okay. That was a pack dive today.
Yeah.
We went from AI coding agents
to the nuances of HDR.
Shanghai's bus routes.
Data warehousing deals.
And the ongoing Android app ecosystem tensions.
Yeah. A lot ground covered. Hopefully we've pulled out the key insights and memorable details for you without it feeling overwhelming.
That's the goal.
And what's really striking is how connected it all feels, doesn't it? AI advancements impacting software, which impacts everything. Tech adoption, like HDR taking time. Platform dynamics, like with Nextcloud. Consolidation, like Databricks Neon.
Definitely. So maybe something to think about as you go.
Sure.
How do we balance all this rapid technological progress with actual user control and choice?
And what does the future of our cities look like with evolving transport? How will these power dynamics between big platforms and smaller players continue to shape our digital world?
Lots to chew on there.
Absolutely. Understanding these trends and the different viewpoints is pretty crucial as tech keeps reshaping things.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We hope it was informative and gave you a good snapshot of today's tech conversations.
Hope to see you next time.
Join us again for another exploration of the Hacker News Forefront.